This interview is being recorded as part of a series for the Australian Garden History Society's National Oral History Project. My name is John Moorer, and it's an interview with Sir Owen Croft and is recorded in St Leonards, New South Wales on Monday, the 23rd of April 2018. This is interview one of a series. Owen, for the recording, can you give me your full name, please?
Owen Glendower Croft.
And your date of birth?
26/4/32.
That would make you
86. This week.
This week? Well, happy birthday for when your birthday is. Oh, and we talked about the number of things that we could discuss, and gardens and the Australian Open Garden Scheme was one of the things that you mentioned. And my understanding is that the Northern New South Wales sub-branch of the Sydney branch actually started at Salisbury Court, your home.
Yes, I was the first chairman and my wife was the first secretary.
How did it get started? What was the impetus?
Just general chat, I suppose. Lynn Walker would be part of it. Doug Moffat was another one. I can't think, there were about six or eight of us, and we were throwing things around.
Doug was from Invergowrie.
Yeah. I suppose just general conversation. It was the end of the Open Garden Scheme. And that was the impetus, I think.
The finishing of the Australia's Open Garden Scheme.
I mean, that more or less folded up. And Lynn having been tied up with it, and Sally being tied up with it, that was part of how the conversations must have started.
Your late wife, Sally, and Lynn Walker were...
I think they were the key. And Doug Moffat, certainly. I just got dragged along for the ride.
Now, that must have meant that you went to quite a number of gardens around the New England and Northwest and maybe even further afield.
Well, Sally was chair of the garden selectors for the Open Garden Scheme. So we travelled from Newcastle to the Queensland border, up the coast, up the Tablelands and out in the west.
Mm-hmm.
And that the territory started at Orange, and all points north. So we travelled the garden. Sally, we nearly every opening of an area we'd go and spend a couple of days there. So I got to see a hell of a lot of gardens.
Well, that's interesting given the range that you actually covered.
Yeah.
Now, Salisbury Court, your family property, was part of the Open Garden Scheme as well.
Yes, we opened it six or eight times. All seasons eventually.
Even winter?
Even winter, yes. Because we've got old, big old trees and hedges and things like that. So we did have it. And Sally very deliberately planted old style plants.
Mm-hmm.
So she pushed that very hard right from the beginning. So that gave us the opportunity to open at different times.
What were the things that did best at Salisbury Court?
Can I best say, anything that survived at Salisbury will survive anywhere. Very frost hardy stuff. And a lot of the old plantings. I'm not good on this sort of stuff because I don't really know. I should have brought the list that Sally had of all the plants. There is one there, which is what she's planted. But it was quite deliberate to go back to the older ones because we knew they survived.
Yes.
And Salisbury is very cold.
Now, you mentioned in a previous conversation that you can recall the temperature getting down to as low as -8 Fahrenheit, which is the rough equivalent of -13 Celsius.
Yes, yeah, so it was the coldest winter ever recorded, and a long winter. There are lots of places where there was ice 2 feet thick down around Niangla and things, gullies where the sun didn't get them. And my brothers were skating on a billabong in front of the house.
With a billabong being part of a creek system.
Yeah, it's quite unique. It's it's now closed off, but to have a billabong in high country is quite unusual, and this one is. It's there, and it's, we put a bank around it to lift it up a bit, but still,
yes.
That's an ephemeral lagoon, I suppose, the best way to describe it.
So, very cold temperatures, very long dry spells,
yes.
And some particularly hot temperatures in summertime were a real challenge.
Yeah, I don't suppose we had very much really high temperature. I don't remember the summers being oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, New England, you don't. When you're far enough up not to have 30 degrees nowadays would be getting close. 33, 34 is really hot.
Yes.
So.
And a bit more bearable because of the low humidity.
No humidity, so it's a very bearable one. I mean, you'd knock off because it was hot.
And cooler nights as well.
Cooler nights always. Very cool.
Now, you started gardening yourself when you were quite young.
Yeah, I got dragged into it. I was the eldest of the family. Mum had quite a big garden that was... no water, obviously. A lot of lawn. She had a big rock garden. There were a few hedges. Big vegetable garden Dad had. Only a hand mower. And as the grass got out of hand, I did use a scythe.
A hand mower being a push mower.
A push mower.
Mm-hmm.
I must have been strong. It was, it was big areas. And it always seemed to be mown, my memory of it.
I imagine it wouldn't have been watered to
no water, no.
Not supplementary water.
No supplementary water. I think there was a well, but I don't remember Dad having water in the vegetable garden.
Now, on this property, were there windmills that pumped to higher tanks, which gave pressure both for the house and... for any hoses that might have been used?
Salisbury, no, Carew, where we were. No, there were only tanks around the house.
Just rainwater tanks?
Yeah, just rainwater tanks. So it was, we didn't have electricity, none of those sort of things. I mean, until 1947, I'd never switched the light on except when I went to town.
When did Salisbury Court get electricity?
The original part of Salisbury was taken up by taken up about 1835 was the original settlement.
Very early.
Yeah, so it's very early. And that run originally started at Wallen and went right through to Armidale.
So that's north of Walker.
Yeah, north of Walker. Not very far north, in actual fact. So it's about 15, 16 k's south of Urella,
mm-hmm.
right through to Armidale. That was all the one run. And then they sold off, presumably the run, Salisbury and Terrible Vale were sold off, and they've taken up about 1836 or 1837, and then the Salisbury portion, Mackenzie, who had it at that stage, went broke in the drought in 38 or 39, and Marsh took over then. Mackenzie.
And Marsh is your direct ancestor.
Matthew Henry Marsh is my great-great-grandfather, and his brother. So my two great-great-grandparents lived in my Salisbury homestead. Is quite unique.
Great, great grandparents.
Yeah.
So the house itself, when was that built?
Started Boxing Day, as far as I know, 1844. Matthew came out in 1840, admitted to the bar in Sydney, but didn't practice. Became the first magistrate in New England. Left England because law was too crowded.
Too much competition.
So he. Once he took over Salisbury, which was about 30 odd thousand acres, the next move by 1842 had been Wurrung, which was, to my knowledge, about 100,000 acres. He was the first man to ride from where Stanthorpe is now to Warwick, first white man.
Yes.
Must have been in drought, I think. He went up to Warwick because the Leslie family had moved up. They brought sheep up along the western side. The Leslies had married two MacArthur girls, so that's where they got their flock from.
The John MacArthur family.
Yeah. So he went, well, John and his brother, I'm not sure. He went up there, and must have been a drought, I think, because he came back to Stanthorpe, basically. I think it was green there. The rest was looking a bit dry. And he took up 250,000 acres in one slam. And if you look at the Queensland border, it comes a straight line and then got a bit of a lip and come around. And he's in the middle of that lip.
Yes. Now that follows one of the rivers, doesn't it?
Well, it's the top of the Clarence. The catchment is actually on Maryland Station.
Oh, okay.
So it's in behind. It's over the border. Because when Queensland became a separate state, the western boundary of Maryland was the Queensland border. It ran along the range, right through. And as Sally used to say, because Matthew had a lot to do with Queensland becoming a separate state, just keep the old bugger out of Queensland. Yeah, well, we all have our views. Anyway, so that was by 1843, he had 400,000 acres under his control.
That's an enormous amount of land.
Yeah, most of it was rubbish. He was a very bad picker of land. Salisbury is the only good place.
And what's the soil at Salisbury?
It's a very fine granite, a lot of it. A lot of ironstone.
Free draining?
No basalt on it. Very good sheep country. Mm. Always was. It always will be. Not really cattle country. But it became one of the big breeding places for the rest of the stuff. But so by 1844 he went back to England to get married. He was always in a hurry, this guy. He really was. He caught a ship, sailed back to England, got married, came straight back. He was back by the end of 1844. And Eliza Merriweather, his wife, we've got one of her diary for 1 year when she first arrived, and she was saying that she and Matt walked up to the site of the new house. And that was just before Christmas in 1840.
This is the site of the new house at
Salisbury. Where Salisbury was going to be built. Now that was finished by 1847, it was finished. It's a big house. It's 90 odd foot frontage for four rooms.
And what's its construction?
Stone, random rubble, I think is the best way of describing. The stone was cut by using fire and water. There are no signs of chisel marks on any of the granite.
How was fire and water used?
Well, they chip a line across a boulder.
Yes.
And they put a fire on it, and then they pour cold water.
And this was granite.
Yeah, it's granite off the place, within most of within probably 300-400 yards of the house. Mm-hmm. And then there's pits on timber all through it. Still got the shingle roof underneath the iron, and
so that'd be hardwood shingles.
Yes, they're all stringy bark shingles. We know that the timber was pit sawn down on where Morani Station is now. There's still the pit there.
And that's toward Walker.
Yeah, adjoining property in those days. In fact, it was part of Salisbury, oddly enough. The Yorala Shire and Walker Shire boundary was the back end of Salisbury. Morani Homestead, Mrs. Walker, and the shooting shepherds in Yorala. So it was all shingles, and all the architraves and everything like that are cedar. Big slabs of cedar too, not just boards. They were, the walls were about 18 inches, 2 feet thick, mm-hmm. right through, and all the architraves on the doors was one sheet of cedar about 2 inches thick. The cedar in the house is probably worth more than that property.
were those architraves milled?
I don't know what. I've been trying to find out where the cedar came from. The doors and windows and all those sort of things were certainly probably made in Maitland, where all the artisans were.
Yes.
But the rest of it we don't know. And I talked to a family called Chapman, who had one of the original big mills at Port Macquarie, and they've got no record. So my feeling is the cedar could have come from down the Hunter.
Mm.
But who knows? I mean, there was no road to Port Macquarie when this place was built, or was a track. But they may have got it. There was a lot of cedar, or east of us was cedar everywhere.
When did Oxley go through?
About 1830.
So not long before.
No, it's not all that very long, mm-hmm. very early. I mean, these were very early days. Why somebody went past Salisbury to somewhere else, I don't know. Never had trees. Salisbury Plain was Salisbury.
So Oxley went from west to east.
Yeah, he went from Tamworth virtually to Walker, mm-hmm. and then went east from there.
Down over the falls.
Down over the falls. Mm-hmm. An interesting comment in here is that it was open woodland, it wasn't heavy scrub, as everybody thinks. That, and if you read any of the Aboriginal books that I have, particularly The Greatest Estate on Earth, most of the timber was on the ridges,
mm-hmm.
and then they burnt down on the top, so you didn't have much vegetation at all.
Yes.
There was no understory. Everybody's been on about this understory, but it wasn't there because it was burnt, except on the ridges.
So the Aborigines burning...
Kept the timber down. I think a good example is Pilliga scrub.
Yes.
Which is now three times as big as it was when white men came, because they stopped burning. That's why they should be getting all their gas out there. Useless country.
Well, I guess one of the reasons why Pilliga scrub has fire would be because there's an understory.
Yeah, there's understory right through, and it's not very big timber either. And when they get a fire, they really get a fire.
Yes, yeah, and it can burn for a long time.
I think, who was the maker, Bradley? Never mind. He certainly said it's three times as big as what it was.
Yes.
I mean, the country is very poor.
Just getting back to Salisbury Court and the beginning of the Garden History Society, do you recall how many people were involved in the Northern Breakaway Group?
About eight of us.
Right.
I don't think there were. We've got them in a book. Bill's got that now. So it's
Bill Oates, the current chair.
So he's got. I found them only recently and gave him the whole lot, and the treasurer's report. So it's all recorded.
Yes.
Fortunately, and hasn't been lost.
And that's kept at the.
At the Heritage Centre.
So, UNE.
Yeah, so that's all there. I don't think. No, I can't remember who the others offhand.
Now, my understanding is that there must be at least 60, perhaps approaching 70 members in northern New South Wales. Was there a steady growth of membership?
Oh, it's been very steady. Initial days, obviously, wasn't much. But once it got going, it built on itself. And then, of course, once the Rose Garden became a part of it.
This is
the Heritage Rose Garden. That's really given more impetus.
Now, my memory is that began in 2013.
Yes, that's about right.
The Garden History Society conference was in October 2013.
Yeah.
I think that we turned the first
site. Well, that's where we got the money from to start it, basically.
Yes. So, what impact did the Heritage Rose Garden have in terms of membership and involvement of people?
I think it's had a very big one. It's widened our grip, and it's also brought people who, for all sorts of reasons, didn't like Somers or the implication of the big grazing and so forth.
Yes.
So we've got other people come in, but we've got a couple of members who came from Sydney and moved up there, who are members of Garden History down here, and they've moved in. And there's a steady build up. Everybody was scared, I think, it was going to be such a monster to manage. In actual fact, there's hardly any work to be done in it. It's quite incredible.
Yeah.
We've just finished the last of the mulching on the first part. Now I know what we should do. We'll mulch much heavier in the new part.
Yes.
But we could do the whole thing this year, and after that, you go around and get a few weeds, deadhead and prune. I mean, there's a lot of work, but it's not going to be any huge effect I have to take over Somers Garden.
I understand that Lynn Walker's husband, Richard Byrne, has provided what I think he calls torpedo hose for my garden.
Brilliant.
You've used them.
I've used them. Mm-hmm. Another chap from Sonic Village, where I am, who takes me around, we got one each, and I use it at home. But we went right through the whole garden in under 2 hours, and we did the whole lot with these things. They're brilliant.
That's quite remarkable.
They really are. For a gravel path, and it's either a push or pull.
This is quite different to
the standard
hoe.
Yeah.
It's a thin metal blade.
Thin metal blade.
With a curve.
Yes, it's shaped. It's nearly oval, I suppose, but sharp on all four sides. And it really is, for that garden, so much mulch, so there's not much stuff coming through.
Now, the blade of this torpedo hose effectively is horizontal, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's a matter of pushing.
Just
and
pushing
and pulling.
Yeah, and it's light. It's so easy. I mean, two of us just sailed around it, did all that. They've been spraying on the new part.
Yes.
But there was still a lot of stuff. We went right through it in a couple of hours.
And it works on the decomposed gravel paths as well.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. I mean, an hour a week for one man, there wouldn't be a weed in it.
Well, that really is.
And that's the incredible part.
Yes.
I mean, the main, looking after the roses is another story. But there's not going to be as much work as for volunteers as we expected. Certainly not as much as I do.
Now, there'd be, what, a couple of dozen people, or between 18 and two dozen people go to regular working bees, monthly working bees?
Yeah, not always the same ones, though.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few. There are a few old hardheads.
Mm-hmm.
Brian Duff and I go out on odd times to do a bit, well, without being... we can get the barrows we want. So we've done a lot of the heavy mulching.
Yes.
Fit enough. That's the easy part to do.
And what sort of mulch are you using?
Well, wood chip.
Mm-hmm.
A big elm tree fell down, so that's all went into it. So and the council's been providing a lot of stuff, so that's not going to be a major problem. I don't know how long it'll last. I think we'll probably get 10 years out of it. Because we're putting about 6 inches of mulch on.
Yes.
So it should last a long time. There's not much weed coming through.
Is there any nitrogen drawdown, given that it's wood chip?
Not by the way the roses are growing. I mean, they're incredible. I don't know how long since you've been there, but in some paths you have trouble walking down. There's so much growth coming out.
It would be 15 months since I've been there.
Yeah, well, it's grown out of all proportion, so there's going to have to be a very hard prune this coming season.
Yes.
But that way, I mean, it's most of it could be done. 10 people could probably do it in 2 days. So.
Now, my understanding is that the soil in the Heritage Rose Garden is basalt.
Beautiful. Yes, because it... It was the original orchard for Solomon's. It's been drained, so there are actual drains in it, earthenware pipes, about 3 feet down.
They were put in by F.J. White.
By the ones, yes. Yeah, F.J. White did it. And they brought soil in from Ebor and a horse and dray.
This would have been in the 1880s, 1890s?
No, it would have been
earlier.
In the 1900s.
Oh, okay, yes.
Once you got the place into order, and then you started to have people coming in.
Yes. Pre-World War One.
Oh, yeah. It was in the early 1900s. But the story is that they actually dug it all up, took it outside, shook the rocks out and put it back, whether that's right or not. But it's the most beautiful soil.
Yes.
And deep. They put an automatic watering system in, which I don't think they should turn on too often, because roads don't need too much water.
That's right.
And with this mulching, I mean, once we got rid of those damn lamb's ears, because they planted lamb's ears initially.
As a border.
And they took off. Instead of being nice little low things, they're 2 feet high. And we spent, I know Brian and I spent at least 2 weeks digging this damn stuff out.
Yes.
There were trailer loads and trailer loads and trailer loads going out of these damn lamb's ears.
Well, I guess it's a good illustration of how good the basalt soil is.
It's brilliant.
Mm.
They haven't had to feed anything yet. Maybe later on they will.
Mm.
But the roses go down 2 or 3 feet, and pure basalt, what else do they need?
Yes.
So it's going to be spectacular anyway. The new part will really complement.
It's been said that Heritage Rose Garden is probably one of the most significant projects that a garden history society anywhere in Australia has taken on.
I don't know who planted the one in Tasmania on the Archer property.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know who planted that one. There's another one at south of Melbourne where the sewage farm is. The big old house, there's another one there. They've used grass around the roses, around the beds. I think it might be a bit more work. It's spectacular. Werribee House.
Mm.
But the rest would be some council ones. Trauma would be a council one. I'm not sure where else there are. But no, it'd be the first one done by it. That'll be it. I mean, the potential is huge for sowing cuttings.
Yes.
Lynn and my daughter have been looking at the rose hips for making products to sell through the shop.
Mm-hmm.
So also
these are mainly off rugosas.
Yeah.
I imagine.
Yeah. They're up. Dirty biggest plums there in vast numbers. So it's a way of using them.
Yes.
And now that Somers looks as though they're going to get big money to expand their facilities generally, and their shops should increase. Then, as long as we can do a good deal cuttings from the roses, because it's a collection that's going to be unsurpassed.
Well, having the vast majority of cultivar groups represented in the garden makes it really quite unique.
Yeah. So it really is a unique, very exciting.
So the fact that the Australian Open Garden Scheme folded, Garden History Society started up. This is one garden, but there are obviously a lot of other very significant gardens in the Tablelands.
Yeah, there are huge numbers, big gardens and small gardens. It's always been a region for gardens. My memory is going back to a place like Wongabinda.
Now that's northeast of Armidale.
No, it's east anyway. Yeah, a little bit north. The Wright family built.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember that as a garden, and I remember Diambrin, which is another one which had called his old age. One particular fruit that grew there that you grow on the coast, because it was on the edge of the gorge, they got the warmth there.
Yes.
They could grow lemons and things like that.
Because some of those can be quite frosty.
Oh, yeah. And those places are very cold, can be very cold, but that because of the climate coming up out of the gorge country, they can do other things.
Yes.
Wongabinda's got some magnificent trees that they planted when old the original Wright family came there. And that's a significant garden which we haven't dealt with yet, which we've been dealt with sometime soon. And then within town, my grandmother built a magnificent garden, a place called Canandra. And she blasted the whole thing out of basalt, built basically on rock walls everywhere.
Yes.
She was very, used a lot of gelignite. They were always reckon that a whole of Armidale was shaking and say, well, Alice is at it again.
Where's Canandra located?
Up near the top roundabout.
On the northern side?
On the northern side.
Yes, and it's a blue brick.
I went there this week and it was horrifying.
Yes.
It's had three or four different owners. I had photos taken of it, which I was to take to the prison owners so they can have a look at it.
Grandmother was there for some time.
Yes, they built the house in about 1904, and she was there till the war, 1945.
Can you describe the garden?
Well, it's on basalt. It had a lot of stone walls right round, which my uncle built, I believe. There was a circular centre with it. Cemented stone wall right round it, only about 2 feet high, and inside were more rock gardens. There was a fish pond. In those days, there were no gravel paths, they were all soil paths, so somebody had to do an awful lot of weeding
and
raking and rolling. And then outside, there were more rock walls, there were vegetable gardens. You had a lot of grape arbor. There was a grape arbor which was about 20, 30 yards long with different varieties of grapes on it. Very big vegetable garden. They used to pick, when the asparagus season was on, they'd go and pick a 4 gallon drum full of asparagus every few days. And they'd tie them in bundles. And I'd never eaten asparagus beyond the first inch of the. I mean, those stalks just threw them away.
Now, the grapes that were grown, some of them were for table grapes.
They were all table grapes. We've got one at Grape and Salisbury, which is a survivor from that garden. The rest were, I wouldn't have no memory of them. I used to eat a large lot of them.
Yes.
But they were all various different. This is a white grape that was rescued by my uncle. We got a cutting from him.
Do you know the name of it?
No. I mean, we've got grapevine sorcery, which was planted in 1844, so the old Isabella.
Yes.
So we've still got that.
Yes.
The same plants are still growing there. So, but no, I don't know what any of these other ones were. She had a couple of persimmon trees. I remember being up there. That one of them is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Huge fig tree, gooseberries.
Yes.
There was a very big walnut tree. All these have gone, except the person. There was a big orchard as well.
Growing things like
One I remember was an almond, a couple of almonds, a lot of plums, apples,
yes,
peaches, all that sort of stuff. They had a bit of farming. Gran had an old family, the Maguire family, who worked for him. She was the cook, the handmaid, shall we say. I can still remember the kitchen standing there while she was making bread and all these sort of things. Big kitchen. And the house hasn't changed a lot. They've made additions to it, but the original part of the house is nearly intact, and they tickle pink with these photos that I've got, because they could actually show the furniture and some of them.
Yes.
Some of the pieces are still there. So they've changed rooms. They're just about to refurbish again, so that they can put it back where they were.
How much land does Canoundra have now?
I think it was about 20 acres.
Yes.
Pretty wild. There was a gorge, not just a narrow gully, just full of blackberries in those days. The land hasn't been developed down below the house at all. They pruned it. They lopped all the trees, and the view over Armadale was there.
Looking to the south.
Yeah, but those trees are up again now.
So
she had a lot of succulents. I can remember the succulents everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob Pierce, who bought it from one of the next neighbour, he used to ring up and say, "What was under this pile of stones?" I can remember these succulents growing in large quantities.
Yes.
But that's... there was quite a bit of lawn.
Just going back to the fruit trees, was it the habit of preserving some of those fruits so that they were available?
Yes, I think my grandmother certainly did it. So I've inherited that. I've just bottled 230-odd bottles of preserves this year.
What have you been bottling?
Bacala. I started off with cherries.
Yes.
And then we move into the stone fruit. I've just finished tomatoes. What else did I do? I don't do vegetables. It's too risky as far as I'm concerned. There are a risk of being too much more. Much higher temperatures. So the cold system.
Yes.
So my daughter used it. I bought them during the season, the fruit season, and she takes them off and makes her jams and stuff, and she sells.
Are you doing the preserving at Salisbury?
No, I do it in my unit.
Are you really?
Yeah. Well, the new Vicola is so easy. It only takes 5 big bottles, it takes 8 little ones. You just put the bottles in there after you fill them. Fill it up with water, turn the power on, an hour later you take it out.
So,
so easy.
The hard work that used to be.
Oh, well, you had to watch the temperature the whole time with these damn things on the stove. It was a monster, but this is so easy. I can have another lot ready. You know, cherries and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I can have them ready for the next, by the time, so I can do 3 lots in an afternoon.
Well, that's quite remarkable.
Yeah, so, I'm the last of a dying breed, I think. But it's such a magnificent way to store fruit, particularly in the winter time. You don't, it doesn't lose its taste. I don't put sugar in.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the bottle and it's ready. And if somebody comes, and I use it now, if I go and get asked out to dinner, I take my bottle of fruit, then I get a lot of brownie points.
You probably get a lot of invitations.
Well, I seem to be getting some. But it's fun. I enjoy it. Some people would find it tedious, but it just suits me, my temperament. It fills in time.
Yes. Oh, and you've lived in the New England pretty much all of your life.
Mm-hmm. Other than 5 years in Sydney.
Yes.
So, lived there, went to school there. We got married there. So, yeah, I've been there for a long time.
Yes, and you and Sally gardened there.
Yeah, well, Sally was the gardener. I did the hard work, and she had the brains. I thought I knew a bit about gardening, but I don't. we used to have lots of conversations, but she was the brains.
Well, I guess all of us start off totally ignorant as far as gardens are concerned, and then you pick up things along the way.
And I worked with Grant Weaver at Canoundra while I was too young then. But then when I was in Tassie, she had a place in Faulkner Street, and we used to spend every Sunday about three of us would go up there and work for a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours, and we'd get a large meal, we'd go to sleep for the afternoon. But you got a new garden out of it.
Better than boarding school.
Yeah, yeah. So it was great for us and great for her.
Yes.
So I've been caught up in gardens, whether I want it or not. My knowledge of plants and things is appalling. I know what's a weed and what's not. That's about the best way of describing me. But I like weeding, so that's not a hassle.
Well, the fact that you and your colleague Brian go out sometimes surreptitiously to the Heritage Rose Garden at Saumarez means you obviously enjoy it.
Oh, we thoroughly enjoy it. Brian needs a bit more exercise because every Friday we go down to Salisbury. Well, we work at McCrossin's Mill in Yarrow, we do the garden there in the morning, then we go out to Salisbury, just gives us lunch. We work 2 or 3 hours, have afternoon tea, get a doggy bag and go home. So we're still in gardening all the time.
Yes. So you've referred to not